Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased to be talking today by telephone with the writer and librarian Maureen Millay Smith. Maureen is a librarian for the Hennepin County Library System at the Edina Library in Edina, Minnesota. She's going to be talking with us today about her new book entitled The Enigma of Iris Murphy, which won the Tartt's First Fiction Award for 2016. Hello, Maureen.
Hello, Tom Hill. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thanks. It's really great to be talking to you on the phone. I want to talk about your writing, of course, in your book, but I'm also interested in your work as a librarian in a public library. Our program is, to some extent, about libraries. So can you tell us about the community of Edina, Minnesota, and about your library?
Sure. I have worked here in a community library for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And when you live in a community and you work in a library like that, you know people, you watch them. You see small children grow up and go away to college and come back and bring their babies in, and there's a senior center underneath, and mm-hmm. you watch people who at 67 were biking across France, and you know them at 87 as well, uh-huh. at a different part in their life. So they have a lot of stories, but it's a big reading community, mm-hmm. and people do a great deal of research in the library. Like today, I spent a half an hour on a question related to chemical, trying to buy a certain chemical. So I spent 30 minutes on that. It's very cold, so many people were doing their research by telephone rather than leaving their abode. And so when I work as a librarian, especially doing readers' advisory services, mm-hmm. I have really come to have a huge respect for writers, for graphic novelists, for mm-hmm. artists, because one of the things that I've come to realize is that it has to be truly almost a labor of love, because many of the people that we love so much as writers sometimes go decades before they make any real money from the work that they do. And people always ask me, so when are you going to quit and live on your proceeds? And I'm always glad when it works out that someone can make a kind of a real living from their writing. But it's been just a lovely job, because almost every day I have a wonderful encounter. Uh-huh. I love it. I love to serve people, and I love when questions are put to me or when we work on programs, literary programs for the community. It's almost hard to tell people how much I love being a librarian, uh-huh. and I really love being a writer. I love to write, but I do love working in the library.
Well, in both cases, in a way, you're dealing with at least an idea of the same public, aren't you? They're the reading public. I mean, people go to libraries and people who read fiction. So,
And sometimes people who are big readers, you know, they have a high benchmark for what they want in their reading, and their patrons that I serve. I can see that they agonize sometimes before making the decision to read my book, mm-hmm. because I'm their librarian and they want only to like things about me.
Uh-huh.
And most of the time, I think that people have enjoyed the book. A few patrons have found certain materials offensive, so I don't recommend my book to certain patrons.
Yeah.
But that's just being a public librarian.
Yeah.
And it's being any kind of librarian,
yeah.
because we all deal with materials that suit one patron but not others.
It must be a way to gain insight into the lives of people, encountering them in the library when they have questions about things that are important to them. But I suppose you have to be ready for anything.
I know. When my first book was published in 2006, it's a novel called When Charlotte Comes Home,
uh-huh.
I felt really exposed. You know, you write in private, and this book came out, and a patron came in and he said to me, I bought your book. I read a lot of my work aloud.
Mm-hmm.
It's something very private that I've created, and I love writing so much, and I love creating stories. I always feel honored when people read it, incredibly honored, and they can have any opinion about it that they want,
mm-hmm.
but I still love the work, and it wouldn't put me off now. I mean, someone said something rather cruel about my first novel to me, and I had a a colleague, Judith, a librarian. She said, Maureen, consider the source, and now we'll get on with our day.
So, yeah.
She said, come on.
Yeah.
Think about, consider the source, as they always said in library school.
Yeah.
And the source wasn't worth, and was almost like, in a good way, she was telling me, give respect to the person, but you don't have to respect that point of view.
Yeah,
it was
sure.
pretty harsh.
Yeah.
So,
do you read reviews of your work then?
When Charlotte was published, the publishing house did not send out advance review copies, so I didn't get any reviews. But it did win an award. It won the Minnesota Book Award for novel and short story. A local book reviewer couldn't review it because they wouldn't send her an ARC. But she did choose it as her favorite book of the year. But this time I did get reviews, and they were both very positive. But one of them said something about dialogue, and so I thought about what she said about the dialogue, and my editor basically told me I was crazy just to ignore it. And what I've come to realize even about any kind of review is that even good reviews, you have to put your distance with them, and I'm ever so thankful for them.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm in the midst of writing something else, so I appreciate them, but I know writers who don't read their reviews,
don't read
anything related to their books.
Yeah.
And I'm probably somewhere in the middle. Actually, I have to say, quite frankly, I was thrilled to have reviews because they mean something. And so we'll see with the next book. I'm knocking on wood here what the reviews are.
So this is your second book then, The Enigma of Iris Murphy. So what about When Charlotte Comes Home? Was that the same kind of book? Was it a collection of short stories or was it a novel?
When Charlotte Comes Home was a coming-of-age novel narrated by a gay museum curator. And it was set in the 1960s, and it was about this man named Fred Holley's senior year in high school in Omaha, Nebraska. And Charlotte is his sister, his youngest sister. So it's through the lens of a man who's in his 50s. And at the time, I thought of the 50s as being very old because I was writing it in my late 30s and early 40s. Not so old.
No.
Quite a young person these days. And so Fred writes this story of his sister is very ill and their life that year. And it's a coming-of-age novel and how he both fell in love with art in art museums, but also fell in love with another young man. So that was really interesting. I worked on that book about 7 or 8 years, and it had 3 or 4 iterations. And one iteration was my MFA thesis at Hamline University in St. Paul. I went to night school and worked on that. And it was great. But it's very, very different than The Enigma of Iris Murphy. And I think that The Enigma of Iris Murphy was very freeing for me. And I love Fred Holley and his family. But just to move on to a totally different world and different sensibilities. And then again with this next novel that I'm working on in the same way. And there are days I miss Paul Simmons. I miss the characters.
Well, that's interesting.
I do miss them.
Yeah, they become like friends, I suppose, after a while.
Yeah. There's a famous Anne Tyler essay where she doesn't write too much about herself, but it was about her writing life as a woman. And part of it was that she said, and I have it somewhere, I actually reread it on an occasion, and she talks about to her, part of heaven, if there is a heaven, would be to meet her characters and find out how their lives turned out. And I've written 2 other novel manuscripts. Neither of them were ever picked up. But one of them sort of dealt with that idea of, so what if? What happens when they go? You know, when a person, where do you go? And how does your life turn out? And I read that essay in the early 1990s. And, you know, I miss them. But you let them go. And they have other lives with readers.
That's true. I was thinking, you know, when you're talking about this, a library, in a way, is a kind of heaven for fictional characters, isn't it? A public library, particularly. I mean, they kind of dwell there in an eternal state, in a way. And,
They
can come to life in people's minds as, you know, as they're checked out.
Yeah. And, I always think that Ann Patchett is rubbing shoulders with James Patterson.
Yeah.
You know, you see these crazy, sometimes in a public library, a very juxtaposition of high and low.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I also think that characters would like that, you know.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, if the afterlife is a kind of archive, it won't be so bad for the likes of you and me, you know, so librarians.
No, it
you
won't.
Know?
Well, you know,
we'll be right at home.
Borges, and I'm misquoting, I'm sure, but heaven is some kind of library, you know. But Borges was a librarian.
Yeah, he was. He was a branch librarian in Buenos Aires. Yeah,
loved his work.
George Steiner has an essay, and I think a whole book, called The Archives of Eden. It comes to mind sometimes.
Even as a child and then in college, I just had such affection. I mean, when I would walk into a library or an archive, I would feel at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not like choosing stocks with Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
But I still did. I mean,
I know exactly what you mean. I think that's the case with many, many people.
And our patrons feel that way as well, I think, Tom.
And I always think, you know, I remember getting my first library card as a child. It was my sort of baptism as a citizen, you know. All of a sudden you feel you're an equal with everybody else.
And, that's right.
And you get the same privileges everyone else gets. And, you know, you can take out a book and bring it back. And there's an identity there.
Yes. And I think librarians, or at least in the public library for me, were very kind to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to open doors to the imagination rather than being gatekeepers of any sort.
Yeah.
And when I was thinking about going to library school, I was working as an admissions officer for a very small Lutheran college in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said goodbye to the high school counselors I worked for, and many of them were in one building school, kindergarten to high school.
Yeah.
One counselor said, when I said, oh, I'm going to go to library school, he said, will you do something for me? And I said, yes, what could I do for you? And he said, as a librarian, will you be kind? Will you be nice to the children? He said, we have a librarian here that is so unkind to our children that it turns them off from reading. And he said, you can make the difference in the way you help people about whether someone wants to read or be educated. And it really stayed with me because I don't want anyone who's 86 or anyone who's 4 to feel uncomfortable or not or be afraid or that I'm going to take a book away from them and say, you know, you can't read The Catcher in the Rye.
Yes, yeah.
Which happened, I'm sure.
Yeah, we have this reputation of just sort of shushing people in the library, you know. But
I know.
Most people know we're not like that.
Yeah, especially regular users. But I really took that to heart because the librarians that I had were very kind.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal to get that library card.
Yeah.
And the woman who was the head of our children's room was named Adeline Prue, and she went to Columbia University. I always remember this. Her niece, her grandniece, told me she took the train to Columbia University to study library science in the 30s. She died several years ago, but she loved the library, and she made it for me in Omaha.
Yeah, that's great. So what made you want then to become a librarian? Was it your experience in libraries as a child?
Yes, and the necessity of finding a career.
Yeah.
It was something I thought I would like doing, and when I was a page at the Omaha Public Library, there was a librarian there named Margaret Mars, and she said, you should think about becoming a librarian, and you would just go over to Iowa City and get your master's degree. That's what you need to do. And she planted it. This was my freshman year in college. And my advisor at the University of Wyoming, Janice Harris, said to me, I was thinking about law school, which was probably not the place for my brain. But, you know, a lot of my friends went to law school. I have many friends that are lawyers.
Yeah.
And she said, I think you would be a very good librarian. You should do that.
Yeah.
And I did. I ended up doing it a year or so out. And I've worked as a librarian for 34 years now.
Margaret Mars, it's almost a name that could be a character in one of your books, isn't it? So
I know.
So yes, nice she had that influence on you.
It is.
So then what made you want to become a writer? Was it something that happened parallel or something that happened later? They're both callings that have to do with connecting to people.
You know, two things happened. I got to Iowa City, and there was the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and it was there on campus. And I lived in a boarding house, and Loretta Selick owned my boarding house with her husband, Mike. And when she was a young mother, she used to take tea with the first Mrs. Kurt Vonnegut, when Kurt Vonnegut was teaching there. And I remember standing in the main library where the library school was and seeing a poster for a reading and thinking, that's what I really want to do. But then I just stood there thinking, no, you have to finish this program or you're going to be broke. You know, how are you going to make money? So at the time I was dating my husband, Dan, and he told me, you know, you'll be a writer. You will be a writer. So I worked in Cincinnati for the Public Library of Cincinnati in Hamilton County. And they had a separate fiction department in their main library. And you wrote reviews. It took me a while. Three times I applied for that job. And they took me, I'm sure, with some circumspection, like, oh. But I loved it. I loved reading. I read four books a week for them for about 7 years. Okay, some weeks it was only 2.9 books. And I would write reviews for them. And they were usually about 700 words. And my supervisor, Janet Wee, said, you know, I have a friend who teaches writing. Would you want to take courses from her? And I started with that. It was Women Writing for Change was the school she ran. And then in 1994, we moved to the Twin Cities, and my husband saw an ad in the Women's Press for Hamline University's MFA program, and he cut it out, and he put it on our refrigerator, and he said, you're going to do this, and this is where your first book will come from. And he also, one night, as I was crying after a tough workshop, said he was doing the dishes, and his back was to me, and he turned around, and he said, if you're going to stay in this business of writing, you have to get a tougher skin. Writers can be very mean. And many of my friends that are writers are not mean, but he said, you can't cry every time. You know, there was a restroom off of the main classroom that we would use at night. And thank God for women's stalls. We all cried at some point or another.
Who would guess that creative writing classes would be so rough? But
you know, out of those classes, some of my very closest friends, wonderful people, and they've all taken different paths with their writing. And writing is a practice. And the practice for me has deepened. And a lot of the lessons that my teachers gave to me, things that they said, keep learning and relearning and finally getting closer to what they were trying to teach me about plot or about the fact that you write it all through and then you've just begun. My teachers would say, art is in the revision. The craft is in the revision. It's not the first time around. It's doing it over and over, like painting. I find it to be so.
So do you have a routine then? Do you have to withdraw? We were just talking on the show with a poet, Stella Baratlis, who's also a public librarian in California, and she talked about the fact that she needed to withdraw, especially from her work a bit, because it was intense every day, and have some quiet time, and then she could sit down and write. And she tries to write every day as a practice. So do you have a routine that you go through, a place to write and a time to write?
Thursdays are a big writing day for me because it's usually my day off. So I tend to begin to write between 10 and 2 on Thursdays. And then in the evenings, on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And then I write even sometimes on Friday after dinner. If I go a couple weeks without some substantial writing, I almost feel emotionally ill.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think for some people, it's like knitting. It's where I go. I go into those characters. It's funny. I always think I would never give up my family or friends, but I've given up shopping. And like my character, Iris Murphy, and my dear friend, Rosemary Furtock, I love clothing, and I like to go shopping, and I don't mind doing it alone. I don't do it in groups. Rosemary was the only person I ever shopped with, but I feel like there are certain things. Like I used to dream of being a really great chef, like Lori Colwin, who wrote for Gourmet. I mean, she was a writer and a novelist. But now I try and make the best food that I can, but it's not where I go for the A. That's where I go in my writing. And when I was younger, I used to wonder about wanting to be a great cook. But as much as I admire that world, that creative energy goes to my writing. I have a real sense of finitude. When I was in my 20s, I felt like I had 100 million questions I might answer,
yeah.
opportunities. Now I feel like this is where I want to focus this creative energy, mm-hmm. is right. here.
My friend Sally Kyle, who's a Jungian therapist, would say your sensation function is really operating here, probably in your writing, where you get
yeah.
such satisfaction. But it would also have to do with shopping for clothes and cooking. So,
and I do enjoy both of those,
yeah.
but I've made certain days where I would have broken from writing and gone. I love to just go window shop sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't do it that much. I don't yeah. do it like I once did
yeah.
because I feel like, oh, I have to use my time wisely.
Uh-huh.
And there is the internet for that.
Yeah, yeah. That's true. There is the internet. So Agnes Murphy, tell us about Agnes Murphy.
I love the name Iris.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really like the flower as well.
Yeah.
But I had a cashmere sweater that was made by a company named Iris Singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to use the name Iris for her name. And I had this idea of this woman one day.
Mm-hmm.
It was right after Easter
mm-hmm.
in 2010. It was after Easter. It was Holy Monday,
mm-hmm.
I guess they call it. And I had this idea of this woman who was a public defender
mm-hmm.
who was driving to the prison in Lincoln, Nebraska to see a prisoner. So it began with this drive, and she was listening to Dvorak's New World Symphony, is that mm-hmm. what it's called?
Yeah.
And why she was going there. So I worked this story about Iris Murphy, and it's not in the book,
mm-hmm.
but that's the genesis. That's where it began. I was in her head, and she just became very dear to me. But then what happened was, in the next two stories, one is about a police officer. Iris needs his help. His name is Clayton Santos Anderson,
okay.
and he's the police officer who's in the property crime division
mm-hmm.
who wakes up and his daughter's crying, his ex-wife is yelling at him all on his BlackBerry, and he gets there and he meets this woman, Iris Murphy, and he's very aware of her because she works as a public defender in Omaha,
yeah.
and police officers have opinions,
mm-hmm.
and it isn't because there are anti-public defenders,
yeah.
but they're not especially enamored of people who make comments about police officers, nor are they very enamored of felons.
Mm-hmm.
So I work on that story.
Your work is very character-driven, isn't it? I mean, it's around characters.
Yes.
Yeah. And the form it
yes.
takes, this is basically a book of short stories, but it reads as a novel. But the stories focus on this character development, and you're making these characters, don't they?
Yes, yeah. and they have to feel real to me.
Yes.
The details and the words have to work read aloud
mm-hmm.
because I want them to sound right when people are reading them,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense,
yeah.
the language. And I do a lot of research. I was thinking about the story Sleeping with Giraffe with the character Kenneth Yellow Dog and Cameron Kill's Pretty Enemy. Kenneth Yellow Dog comes from the Rosebud Reservation, St. Francis. It's a small village there.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in South Dakota in the 1980s and a little in the 1990s for the Upward Bound program
mm-hmm.
at Black Hills State University. I worked tutoring in rhetoric and introductory English courses for the students taking college courses there in the summer
yeah.
that were part of Upward Bound. But they came from all over the western part of the state of South Dakota
yeah.
and also parts of the high schools and reservations in North Dakota as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Standing Rock was one. The students from St. Francis were there as well.
Yeah.
And so these are not based on any of my students. You know, these are not their stories because I feel like their stories are private and they're their stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I made them up. One of the things that I did some research on were dogs on reservations.
Uh-huh.
Feral dogs, not
yeah.
wild dogs,
yeah.
but feral dogs and animals. And for Kenneth's family, they have this ability to understand the thoughts of animals.
Very interesting, the Native American characters that you've drawn here, who seem to get in trouble with the law, in part because of this relationship they have with animals.
Right. Working for Hennepin County, I did some book talks
mm-hmm.
at the county home school, which is where teenagers are sentenced,
mm-hmm.
And I also worked at Shakopee, which is the women's prison. And I did a book talk there. There was a book club at the women's prison library in Shakopee, Minnesota. And so, especially at the women's prison, you just sense how many people in the prison, they just got such a bad start in life.
Yeah.
And when they leave, many of them are not going back to a good situation.
Yeah.
And I guess that really stayed with me. And for someone like Kenneth Yellow Dog, who's a librarian, who, because of a situation, ends up in prison, it was just heartbreaking to me. And how people will sometimes end up there. He was not so endeared about some of these animals, but he loved his parents. And
He goes to prison because he rescues from the zoo a sort of prize donkey, right, that is beloved
right.
by
his
the local population. And he squirrels him away with his parents, and then the parents get blamed for it. And so to keep his parents from going to prison, he goes to prison. Yes, so
well, and in actuality, I think his parents took the donkey. He knew it was at his home where his parents lived with him.
Okay.
But then it was noticed that the donkey was missing. It isn't like a chicken dying, because those things do happen.
They don't worry so much about that.
But the donkey was beloved, and it was finally found. And his parents had, especially his father, had health issues. It's really very real to someone who's a minority in our country. They are very afraid of how the law might treat them.
Yes, with good reason. And, oftentimes, the people I talk to on the show are academics who write academic books, and a big theme in academic writing anymore, especially in the social sciences, is the injustice of the criminal justice system, especially the prison system. So we've got someone that teaches here, Susan Leonard, who just wrote basically a criminology textbook on exactly that. So, you know, your book here then sort of addresses this situation. I mean, you know, when you look at American society, that's one place where there's kind of a big dark spot and a place that needs attention. And then the Native American aspect also was certainly very timely with Standing Rock going on. As I was reading this, you know, I kept thinking people should be reading this book because it has to do with the minority status of Native Americans and their invisibility to some extent and the way they do tend to run afoul of the law. So the question here is, I know your work is very character-driven, and Iris is a public defender who defends this Native American. So the question is, are you influenced here by American writers like Dreiser or Sinclair Lewis, especially from the Midwest, I'm thinking, who wrote in this social justice tradition? You mentioned in the book that one of the characters, one of the Native Americans, I think it's perhaps the Native American lawyer, points out that we have more people in this country in prison than Stalin ever had in the gulags.
I know.
Yes. Anyway, there's an engagement in this book with pressing social issues and makes me think of that whole tradition, Steinbeck, Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis. There's a lot of local color in it here, too. It's very much a Midwestern book. You know, I'm from Detroit myself, and I recognize that, you know, attitudes of people.
This weekend I was talking to a cousin of mine. His name is Ben Caprero, and he works as a lawyer comic. He does a lot of human resources law in a very funny way to get points across. But one of the things that he said about true writing, whether it's for humor, it's got to ring true. It has to ring true. And that's really, really important to me. And I think what is really painful to me is that you can abut states like Minnesota abuts North Dakota and South Dakota, and then northern Minnesota has Ojibwe reservations, and people who really have never spent any time among Native Americans have a lot of big opinions about them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
My thought is that where other groups that live in urban worlds tend to get to know each other or have opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Not always perfect or anything, but it's very different. Because I remember my students used to say to me, well, you're white and you have no culture.
Mm-hmm.
We have a culture. And I remember I was pretty young then. I was in my early 20s. And I thought about it and I thought, well, I do have a culture. I don't really want to discuss my culture. I didn't think about it, but I was also thinking, you know, the African Americans I know probably know white culture better than whites know it. And we sort of know them.
Mm-hmm.
They really know us. But Native Americans, because many of them live on reservations, they do know us, but they don't know us.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're that interested in knowing. And why would they want to be?
Yeah.
But high rates of them serve in the military. They're very proud of serving in the military. They have family history. They love their country. But they really do feel that pipeline going through. I completely support blocking that pipeline.
I was going to say, they're all out there supporting all of us.
Sometimes I think I'm active in Rotary, and I love Rotary. But I said one day to a friend of mine, I said, sometimes, you know, I really believe in bringing students from other parts of the world here and sending Americans to other countries. But I think Americans need to get to know the various parts of their world.
Yeah.
Americans should visit Flint, Michigan. I read a memoir written by a man. One of my editors that I work for, her name is Angela Johnson, recommended it to me. There's a man who lives in San Francisco, and he wrote a memoir about trying to buy a house in San Francisco and then going back to Flint. He dreamed of trying to save part of Flint. And there are people really doing that, but this writer grew up in Flint. And he bought a 700-square-foot house, like $900,000.
Yeah.
And you could get it 3,000 square feet for $22,000 and gunshot, all in Flint. America is so many different things. You know, we're San Francisco and we're Flint.
It's true.
And Standing Rock.
Yeah, that's one thing that reading fiction like this, it has some ring of truth to it,
yes.
Can do. It can take you into other people's worlds. And Stella, you know, the poet I talked to, said exactly the same thing here. Her poetry was about reaching out, basically, and allowing people to connect to someone that they don't know.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Stella is right. You know, it's trying to go into someone else. But I sometimes think literary fiction has been for me as a reader, but also as a writer, is it takes you into the character's mind and their world. And poetry can do the same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, essays can do the same. But I think in fiction, even if at some point you have a narrator that's sort of tricky or not really completely reasonable, humans can be like that, but it can help you understand the world more. I don't know if I'll ever go to Afghanistan, but Khaled Hosseini opened a window to me, a crack in a window of what the issues are there and what it's like to be an Afghani immigrant refugee in the United States.
So people should spend more time in their public libraries checking out, you know, checking out good fiction. One thing that popped out at me in your book, it had to do with the family who were able to mind read the thoughts of animals. And also the plight of this young man, because his parents rescued the donkey, and he's been in trouble for sleeping with giraffes. He goes into the zoo, and he feels the giraffes are lonely, and he feels compelled to sleep with them. And, of course, he gets caught in the morning and in trouble for it. But, you know, the thing about this is it's something I feel anymore, especially in my Facebook feed. I read all these stories about animals, where animals seem to be people, too. You know, the cat posts provide a lot of comfort, but it isn't just vicarious cuteness always.
No.
It's often about altruism and animal behavior. It has to do with animals often appearing in heroic roles in various kinds of narratives, often being kind to other animals, being kind to people. So, you know, I picked up on this in the book, you know, the sensibility about animals. I mean, animals are an important part of the enigma of Iris Murphy here, aren't they? And then the Native American culture seems to be a kind of avenue for helping us to understand this, yes?
You know, the man who did the cover of the book, the artist who did it, was a man named Stephen Anthony Smith. And Steve lives and works in Manhattan. And I've known him for about 16, 17 years.
Yep.
And he worked for the Shakopee Mattawankaton Indian tribe in Prior Lake, Minnesota. And he told me, we were having dinner together one night, and he said that he had been to a funeral for a member of the tribe, a woman he knew, and that as they were finishing the ceremonies, they were out of doors. And all these birds, these sparrows, came out of these bushes. And there were like dozens of them. And they were all chirping. And he said it was as they were ending the funeral. And he said this woman loved to talk, almost like a bird. And he said to me, I felt like her spirit was rising with the birds. And he told me that story probably 11 or 12 years ago. And it really stayed with me. And that Iris herself, you know, she had those pumps on with feathers, and that she was a bird. and that...
Oh, they called her the bird, that, yes, yes.
Yeah, the bird. Yeah. They called her the bird because she liked to dress beautifully, that she stood out.
Yeah.
She was the bird. And then also, Cameron kills Pretty Enemies, who was her lover, who has a story of his own,
yeah.
or is in a story, or in a few stories, that Cameron says to his son, Miles, I need to be with you because the women around me are like birds, mm-hmm. you know, that they chirp, all this noise. And, you know, I come to you for like this quiet, these two quiet men together where I can be with my son and be quiet. And those kinds of things, the ability to be quiet and mm-hmm. comfortable just in yourself, I think is a part of rural America, which some might say is not a part of me, that I like to talk and tell stories, and I'm noisy. Yeah. I like words a lot. But I think that power of listening, mm-hmm. of being able to go and be quiet, is part of what draws me into, say, libraries, and part of it is what draws me into writing, is that it's in this quiet part of my mind that I'm thinking about my characters.
Yeah.
And they're noisy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes they're noisy, and sometimes they are not very interested in Maureen. They want their stories and their lives. And that, too, is sort of odd. I feel that my characters, that my goal is to find them, mm-hmm. and that they then are, and they are not me.
Uh-huh.
Because they're not my memoir. You know, and I love memoir. It's not about memoir. It's about their stories.
Interesting. Something about the cheeping birds, it's such a perfect kind of, I don't know if metaphor is the right word, really symbol for literature in a way, isn't it? I mean, most medieval poetry starts out with birds singing.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it does. Medieval lyric poetry, Provençal poetry especially, there are always birds twittering in the trees in the first stanza.
When I was a young woman and was dreaming about being a writer, and I would say this, in my heart, I always wanted to be a New York City writer, of course. But I didn't make it there.
Yeah.
So I really can't write about New York City. I can only write about what I know and what I've experienced. And you can learn things. Yeah. Writers, I know, you can do an immense amount of research because even about what you know, you need to learn more to make it real.
Yeah.
You have to keep learning. But I think, you know, the 42nd Street Library and all those people who walked up and down and the people who write about New York, it was an inspiration to me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether you make it there, I guess in anyone's life, you make your life a private Paris. It's a palace inside your mind.
New York is that kind of a symbol for people, writers particularly. It can
be. Yeah, I mean, writers in particular.
Yeah.
But the world that I know is Nebraska, and I know Minnesota, and I actually know Cincinnati. I lived there 11 and a half years, and I really love that city.
Yeah, so all three locales feature in the Enigma Virus Murder, don't they? Yeah, so.
Yeah, they really do.
And stories,
And I really love Omaha. My mother-in-law once said to me a long time ago, she said, you can never leave a place, Maureen, until you have found something to love.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to leave without missing it. You know, find something to love about it. Find something to do. And sometimes I think that's how I feel about my fiction as well. You know, I keep working at it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm working on a story or trying to get to know a character, get in there and find out something about them that makes them someone you care about, even if you wouldn't want to be married to them, have them as your best friend.
Yeah, yeah.
But find their story and try and tell it as well as you can.
Yeah. So do you want to read a passage, anything that you think the audience might like to hear, to give them an idea of Iris Murphy?
Sure. I'll read from the first part of the story, Pardon Palimpsest, because it begins, and I'll just read part of it.
Okay.
A few paragraphs. Okay. And the story, it's the first story, it's called Pardon Palimpsest, and this is how it begins. They smell Iris Murphy before they see her. She wears a faint that could be best described as clean and comforting and probably expensive and not sold at Target. Or at least this is how Kenneth Yellow Dog has always thought of her perfume. It wafts into the visitation area of the Nebraska State Penitentiary in Lincoln, announcing her. The convicted and their guests pause to inhale. momentarily stopping their conversations. Seconds later, when she walks into the room, heads turn. The bird, they say, in astonishment to one another. The convicts all know that this is a rare sighting. Rumor has it that she is afraid of prisons and that bars and razor wire send her into panic attacks. What they know about Iris Murphy is what they've heard about her. Some somebody telling another somebody a story that another guy's cousin swears to be the truth about this public defender. They believe it, though. For them, it is immutable, a fact, a law of the physics that defines the gravity of their world. In this way, as in many ways, felons are like all other human beings. Their beliefs are based in stories.
So it gives you a very nice sense of Iris there right from the beginning.
Walking into the prison.
Yeah, and the way other people see her.
They love Iris Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Because she understands their world. She understands a lot of prisoners don't care about sentencing. They care about where they're going. She understands all that. Iris may really care about clothes, but she doesn't care about anybody else's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
They like that she dresses for them every day because they're her people.
Why is Iris enigmatic? What is the enigma? I mean, is the enigma something that remains an enigma? We don't know.
I think that she...
A woman of mystery.
She's a self-editor, and, you know, in a way, she's an enigma because I don't even know why.
Yes, okay. She's an enigma to her creator,
Maureen
Smith.
Because, yeah. And I think one of the reasons the stories really helped me is that I could see her from different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
But I could not write this book from the point of view of Iris solely because she was too private. You know, she wouldn't talk to me about herself.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Very interesting, you know.
In a way that you want to read it. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. Do you mean her to be a kind of model? I mean, she's a very moral person, obviously. I mean, she makes a point of putting signs for Democratic candidates out on her lawn.
In her yard.
In her yard, yes. So, although all her neighbors are Republicans, of course, and very conservative, you know, it makes her a kind of target. And also, she is a public defender. She is doing this work trying to undo the damage that this kind of conservatism does to people. So, you know, especially in the era of Donald Trump here, I wonder if one of the benefits of reading this book might be, and that you are modeling a kind of way of life here. You know, she's not a brash sort of Wonder Woman of any kind here. But, you know, she's a kind of quiet heroism that you have in some people, especially oftentimes I find women who are professionals of one kind or another that manage to do good work and don't make a big thing of it and manage to live their sort of lonely lives,
You know, years ago when I was working as a page in the Omaha Public Library, I would work in the microfilm room, and sometimes I would help people make copies and file microfilm. But I was reading an article in the Omaha World Herald, and it was about a man, and I can't remember his name, but he had worked for either the Douglas County Defender's Office or for the Legal Aid Office, and I can't remember which one, both of which give legal services to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked to come and be a professor at the law school at Creighton University, which is a Jesuit university in Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
So he did, and he had been a teacher there. And he announced after a period of years that he was resigning from the law school to go back to either the legal aid office or the public defender's office. And it was such news that they put an article about it in the newspaper that he was giving up a professorship to go back to serve these people. And he said he felt honored to have been given this job at the law school, but that this was his calling.
Yeah.
That he was happier there.
Yeah.
And this is where he wanted to spend the remainder of his career as an attorney. And that really stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was 19 years old when I read that. And there's a woman in Omaha, I think she's with Legal Aid, but her name is Myrnie Haney. And when I was first a librarian in Hennepin County, Myrnie worked for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. And she did different things for them, but she prosecuted child abuse case. Uh-huh. She had been in the county attorney's office for about 15 years, and she returned to Omaha because she was very close to her family and her mother was having health issues. She was very respected here in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And she returned to Omaha, and I think she's with the legal aid department. And she told me that, you know, when she returned to Nebraska, either she was for a short time was a prosecutor or was being interviewed to be a prosecutor in Omaha. But she said, you know, when you prosecute crimes in Nebraska, you have to be able to prosecute for the death penalty. And she said, I could not do that. Yeah. I'm against it. So she said, I made another path mm-hmm. here. So there she's done public law of some sort for the past 15 years down there. And I have this friend named Chris Fishbach, and he's the publisher of Coffee House Press.
Mm-hmm.
And he really believes that art has this power, any kind of art. It could be dance or book,
mm-hmm.
but it can really have an action about it. And when I think about Chris and the kinds of books that Coffee House Press publishes, or I think about Mernie Haney or many people, mm-hmm. so many great people in the United States, but across the world, school teachers and
yeah.
social workers, and they are in action. Either it's their craft, their artistic, their words or their paintings or their music. And it isn't because they're thinking about making it art in action, it's just what they're driven to,
mm-hmm.
or even the kind of law you might practice. I think sometimes altruism is not even in the front of people's minds, but it's how these people live. There's this character, Paul Simmons, who is the focus of the story, The Enigma of Iris Murphy,
mm-hmm.
and he's always feeling guilty because mm-hmm. Iris is one of his best friends, but there is no way he would ever practice the kind of law she practices.
Yeah.
But he loves her, and I don't think she wants him to feel guilty. But as a child of great guilt, I mean, I have great empathy for Paul.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, and that's just not Paul's thing. I mean, we yeah. need all these different parts of whatever this human puzzle is. And Chris will talk, Chris Fishbach at Coffee House Press,
mm-hmm.
really in a quiet, passionate way, we'll talk about art in action.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dorothy Day used to feel about, you know, the Catholic worker movement. Chris, I like to hear him speak about the authors that he publishes. And I feel that way about attorneys, and I feel that way about Iris. And even her son, you know, or different characters in that book, they each have their point of view and how they look at life, and even the animals.
Yeah, even the animals, yes, who seem to have a job often, you know, and for dogs especially, that job is taking care of people, yes, in their own doggy way, so.
My cat is sitting in the room, so I should defend all cats. And I actually really believe that they really do need jobs.
Yes,
and they,
yes.
And part of it is to be with you, and
yeah.
they're very concerned about their humans.
They are,
and
yeah.
some people would generally say that I'm anthropomorphizing, and that's an argument. But I really do think that animals have a creative force, and at least for me, they're very good for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I like other people's dogs. I love my cats. One time a veterinarian said to me, he said, you know, what should a child learn from an animal?
Mm-hmm.
And this veterinarian said to me, a child should learn to be gentle. That is the goal. You know, they can't be responsible for live animals, but your goal as a parent with animals and children is to teach gentleness.
Gentleness.
And then gentleness is what you hope that children will take into their lives with other living
yes.
creatures,
yes.
that we need to be gentle, gentle. And, you know, in some dogs, you have to be rather forceful.
Yeah.
I love to read dog books, and
yeah.
the British are so subdued, but we'll say, this breed has a strong character.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
Not a family dog.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
probably would eat your children or something.
So, if you have time, do you want to read another passage? Maybe the,
sure.
the description of Kenneth Yellow Dog there with his animal telepathy?
Yes, I love Kenneth.
These are really interesting characters, I have to say, you have here. So, he's the person that Iris is defending, yes? She goes to
she's
see him.
Yeah. I'll read some about the Yellow Dog.
Okay.
And this is about Kenneth Yellow Dog. It's on page 62, and it's from Sleeping with Giraffes, and that's one of his stories.
Yeah.
Everyone on the reservation knew that the yellow dogs didn't drink. Many assumed it was because the family had converted to Mormonism. This was not the case, or that Louise Freehold, as a white woman, made Stanley sign a religious pledge, nor was this the reason. They avoided alcohol because it interferes with the gift that brought Louise and Stanley together in their later 30s, when everyone thought that Louise was a spinster and Stanley a committed bachelor. She was a woman with an orange tabby cat, and he was a man with a lab Sharpei mix. Both Kenneth and Clarice share this gift as well. The yellow dogs understand the feelings of animals. They can feel the pounding of their hearts and smell the anxiety of a creature's unhappiness. Sometimes they can outright hear an animal's thoughts or see an image bouncing from dog to dog or cat to cat. It is the same with wildlife. My dog Baxter told me that the new kindergarten teacher could understand him, Stanley told Kenneth and Clarice in explaining the genesis of their parents' courtship. I didn't believe Baxter, their dad added after a pause. Then he laughed. But that damn dog was right, and the kindergarten teacher was pretty. Watch your language, Stanley, Louise always adds, shyly, in the telling of their love affair. Growing up, the yellow dog children ate a diet of beans, fry bread, and roasted root vegetables in the winter, and corn, tomatoes, beans, and fry bread in the summer. When a deer was hit on the roads coming into or going out of the village of St. Francis, tribal police officers would call Stanley to come and claim the fresh kill. Roadkill was an accidental protein and always tasted of the freshness of a free life, or at least Stanley always maintained this. Kenneth liked the meals of venison. He still does. Clarice did not, but she would eat eggs from the chickens that Louise kept and drink milk from the family's various nanny goats. Around St. Francis, even at the Indian school, the yellow dogs were considered good people but odd. They were necessary employees in the running of the school, but they were moral to the point of being annoying, encouraging people to neuter their pets and grow their own food. This bugged people, who often could barely get by. Dogs have always run wild on the reservation. Cats give birth to litter after litter, and then they die under the wheels of vehicles or are eaten by coyotes. These are the plain facts of rural America. Stanley and Louise collected roadkill and buried their bodies in an animal graveyard they kept on their property. The family sang hymns and read poems for these departed souls. Kenneth and Clarice made ceramic headstones from kits that Louise ordered through the mail. The fact that Louise Yellow Dog talked to her animals as she worked in the garden while listening to the National Public Radio news shows and classical music on a transistor radio made her seem like a woman who aspired to be something greater. And why shouldn't she, some people said in her defense. But they don't even have cable or a dish when they could afford it. People would say in response to that question, and they don't drink, or even worse, Stanley's gone white.
Interesting family. So you mentioned, you know, you're working on something now. So you're working on another book at this juncture?
Yes. I've been working on it for about, I don't know, 18 months. It's called right now, it's called The Diaspora, The Jones Sisters. And it's about three sisters. Two are fraternal twins, Leslie and Lucy, and they're both pharmacists. And Leslie lives in Minnesota, in Edina, and her sister Lucy lives in Omaha. And then they have a third sister who's 12 years younger, and she lives in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And Leslie's husband left her. He had an affair. They have four children, and he married another woman. Mm-hmm. And so, by court order, they live in a community near each other in Minneapolis, and she works as a pharmacist in her. And so her story is told from her point of view, some of her son's point of view. Leslie is a widow, and she's also a pharmacist, but she lives in Omaha. And her story is told from her point of view, a child's point of view, and a couple others. And then there's sister Sally lives in Cincinnati, and she's 12 years younger, and she's a librarian, but she writes children's readers. Uh-huh. She creates, she's an artist, and she never married, but she has two adopted children who are twins, and then she meets someone named Lyman Brooks, and then interspersed is the story of the Jones sisters' mother and father, Nora and Hugh Jones, and they live in Nebraska City, Nebraska. Uh-huh. So there are love stories involved. So when I was finished with Iris, I was really interested in the idea of what is a love story. Uh-huh. So these are about love stories. And each of these women has had losses. Uh-huh. But they're also love stories, but there are children, adult children involved. And the parents, Nora Larkin Jones, her mother had emigrated from Ireland. So there are different things that go on mm-hmm. in each of the stories. And so they're interlocked stories, similar in a sense to Iris Murphy. And I read recently a book that was very inspiring by Maggie O'Farrell called This Must Be the Place, mm-hmm. which was very structurally helpful to me, although very different kinds of characters than Maggie O'Farrell. And then there's a new book by Ann Patchett that I really liked, and I liked how she developed her book, the structure of it. And that book is called Commonwealth, uh-huh. it's her latest novel. And I've always liked pharmacists. I don't know, they're sort of the medical form of a librarian who often have the answer, but they don't practice medicine, but they're really wonderful, helpful people. So four of these characters are pharmacists, which I am not, nor do I play one on TV. Uh-huh. But so I'm very involved in this book right now. Mm-hmm. And
well, I can tell, you know, you talk about your characters as though you actually know these people. So they're very, very real, aren't they, to you? And then you have a way then as a writer of making them real to your readers.
Yeah.
So I would think over time, if you become a popular author, people will know you through your characters.
I know, and someone once told me that when people really, really enjoy a book, the author can often be disappointing to them because you're not the book. There's something between a reader and a writer, the book, and I really believe that when a reader takes that time and reads the book, that then it is theirs. Whatever feelings they have, that's an artistic reading, is a very artistic process in and of itself.
Yes, yeah. It's tantamount to writing in a sense.
If you
go back and listen to that interview that I did with Stella, I read a passage from Heidegger at the end where he essentially says exactly that, that as a reader, you're basically sort of conserving the work as you read it. And there's an element of care that's involved. And it's a creative act.
I am very thankful for my readers. And I'm also thankful for people like Stella who write poetry. Because I read poetry.
Yeah, me too. A great book is there, Alkali Sink, it's called. So I'd like to thank you, Maureen, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, The Enigma of Iris Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you for reading the book.